Howdy. You know, we've been starting to have more of the sermon slides for about 2 years now. And when I first started putting them up, one of the times we did it, I was showing a math example up there on the screen, and a few teachers were like, "Oh, hey, that's awesome." And everybody else said, "Please don't teach us math." I think I scarred a few people. It was a rough day. But just in case I'm not bothersome enough already with that, I also taught physics. So, one of the hardest things for the students to grasp whenever we were learning physics was the nature of light. See, the thing is that light, it gives us energy in these little packets. They call them photons. Pew, 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 pew. And one bit at a time, pew, pew. It's not this smooth, continuous flow. And that's what light sounds like, too. Pew, 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 pew. But you have to realize is that light, though, it's not just a little particle. It also behaves like a wave. Because if it were just a particle, you would never be able to see it around a corner. It would never be able to reach all these other places where you turn on the light and it somehow manages to creep into every dark corner. You see, that's when their faces got a look just like about half of yours right now, okay? That mix of confusion and just a little bit of quiet rebellion. You know, it's as if to say, that doesn't make any sense, just tell me what to put on the test. And they were right, in a way. It doesn't make sense, not by the categories that we're used to, but it's still true. It works. Light just works. It's a particle and a wave, not one or the other, somehow both. But I remember realizing something at that moment. When something doesn't make sense, many people don't say, if it's true, I'll try to understand it. Instead, they say, if I don't understand it, then maybe it's not true. I saw this again whenever I gave them an assignment on Einstein's theory of relativity, which apparently was in the actual curriculum, and the idea that time and space change depending on how fast you're going and the weight of gravity. And I told them, well, this has been proven to be true. What do you think? And most of them, even though they knew it had been proven to be true, said, well, I just don't believe it. Not because there wasn't evidence, but because it didn't make sense to them. And I think it's something that we never quite outgrow. We're more comfortable deciding whether something feels right than asking whether it is right. When something about God doesn't make sense to us, when he doesn't act the way that we expect, or when his plan doesn't fit our categories, our first instinct is not always to trust him. It's often to question whether God's grace and his love and his very presence are even real. How often things are not going the way we're expecting, and we wonder if that means that God has somehow forgotten us. But God, even more so than light, doesn't fit inside the boxes that we make for him. He's not controlled or contained by our understanding. He just is. He acts. He moves. He reveals himself. And just because we can't fully explain him doesn't mean he isn't there. It just means he's greater than what our minds can hold. And that's the tension that Moses encounters in Exodus 3. Moses, he's not searching for a miracle right now. He's just living life. He's just doing his job. He's tending sheep. He's living his life. He's raising a family. The 401k is doing well. The pension has already been achieved. He's doing great with the deductible on his insurance. And fortunately, the kids, the college fund, it's pretty well settled. Things are good. The excitement of Egypt is long behind him. Whatever dreams he once had of making a difference, they're buried under the routines of survival, the day-to-day. And that's when God decides to speak to him. out of nowhere, in the middle of an ordinary day, the divine breaks in somewhere between the Wheaties of the morning and reading the daily paper. God decides to show himself to Moses. And it's important to remember, though, that Moses never really fit in anywhere. He didn't fit in Egypt because he was a Hebrew, the ones who were oppressed. But he also didn't fit in among the Hebrews because he grew up in Pharaoh's palace, you know, privileged, taken care of. But he, after all of that, though, after he killed the Egyptian who was abusing the Hebrews, he didn't fit in anywhere at all because now he had a criminal record, a man living with his regrets and feeling that there was no place for him in society. Yet that is the man God calls. Not when Moses has his life together, but when he's simply tending someone else's flock in the wilderness. So when Moses hears God's voice, he's understandably hesitant. He wants to know how this could possibly work. Why would anyone listen to him? What if they don't believe me? What if they ask, who sent me? He's not just asking for a name. He's asking for reassurance, for something solid to stand on. And what God gives him isn't a formula or a strategy or one of those really quick phrases that you can come up with and just chant well. It's his name. He gives him his name. I am who I am. It's a name that means both presence and promise. It's as if God is saying, I will be who I will be. I will do what I will do. My being is not dependent on your understanding or your comfort. For a man who had never quite belonged, that's an invitation into something that's larger than just belonging. It's about participating in the living purpose of God himself. But you got to remember, Moses, he probably didn't know the traditions or the stories, Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob, the way that the other Hebrews did, because they had spent all that time listening and learning from the elders. So when God tells him, I am the God of your fathers, he's not just giving Moses words that he's going to say. He's actually giving him a connection to a history that he never truly felt part of. He's being drawn back into the story of his own people through the revelation of God. But here's the turning point. Even after seeing the burning bush, even after hearing the voice, even after realizing he's not actually crazy with either one of them, he still has to decide whether or not to trust it. The people are going to have to do the same as well. Just like those students who had to decide whether to believe once what I taught them went beyond what made sense, Moses had to decide whether to trust God beyond what felt comfortable to him. Because in the end, faith is not just about what we can actually explain because we learned it in confirmation class. It's about who we trust when the truth is bigger than what we grasp. But that same theme continues in Luke 20. When the Sadducees come to Jesus not with an honest question, but with a test. Whenever somebody comes up to me and says, hey, I want to ask you a question, I'm not going to lie, I'm always nervous when I hear that. You know those times whenever somebody says that they're trying to just ask you an honest question or have an open debate or, you know, just let's just kind of put everything on the table. And you always wonder, yeah, but I think you're trying to trick me. Because how often is it that people want to get into difficult questions when they don't already have it in the back of their mind about how to make you look stupid? But you see, the Sadducees, the reason why they were sad, you see, is because they didn't believe in the resurrection. They come up with an example that's meant to sound absurd. Okay? Instead of telling the story of seven brides for seven brothers, they have the one bride for seven brothers. They tell a story about a woman who marries seven brothers, one after another, because each of them dies without leaving a child. For the kids, it was a movie, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. It's somewhere on streaming. Go find it. It'll be great. But Jesus, they ask, in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? And I got to make sure I point out to you, it's important to realize their question is not actually about marriage. That's not the reason they came to talk to him. It's about control. They're trying to control the conversation to expose what they think is ridiculous about the resurrection. The details about marriage and inheritance, those are just props for an argument that they're starting. And Jesus says that in the resurrection, people neither marry nor are given in marriage. We need to be careful. This is not about Jesus dismissing marriage or saying that relationships won't matter. If you're kind of thinking, hey, I kind of like my spouse, I think it would be nice to spend time with them in heaven, it's okay. You can do that. He's not talking about that. That was not the point. He's talking about how the systems of this world, the legal, the social, even the religious ones, they don't carry the same meaning in the age that is to come. Marrying, which in this context was talking about the man's initiative, and then being given in marriage, which at that time was a woman's legal status, these were both parts of a world that were defined by property, inheritance, death. What happens to what you have whenever you pass away? It was asking questions about the legal ramifications. But in the resurrection, the old structures, they don't apply. Because death itself no longer defines what's even possible. But what's fascinating, though, is that even within the story of the Sadducees, their logic fell apart. I mean, even before going into it, anyone who knew that, I mean, technically, the first one was her husband, because all the other ones, when they married her, were giving her children, or supposed to pass on the first husband's inheritance. But notice, Jesus is intelligent, but he doesn't bother untangling the details. He doesn't care. He moves straight to the heart of the matter that they actually were focused on. He is not the God of the dead. He is the God of the living. Jesus doesn't just say it, though. He proves it. His own resurrection doesn't just blow a hole in the Sadducees' logic. It blows open the limits of what we even thought was possible. The resurrection is not just rebutting somebody's theological argument. It's the evidence that God is not bound by death. He's not bound by time. He's not bound by our categories of what makes sense. The Sadducees wanted to keep faith neatly divided. This life or the next. What we can see or what we can't. Human power or divine promise. And we should just focus on the here and now and stop bothering us with this crazy resurrection talk. But in Jesus, the false boundaries, they collapse. The resurrection reveals God is not setting up a choice between caring for this world or caring for the next. It's about redeeming both. Life now and life eternal. They don't compete. It's one continuous story held together by a living God and a God of the living. When Jesus rose from the grave, he didn't just conquer death. He connected heaven and earth. He showed that God's power, it's not waiting until the end of time. It begins now in every act of trust, every step of faith, every moment that we dare to believe that what's possible for us is still possible with him. The issue here is not marriage. It's mindset. The Sadducees cannot imagine a world that operates beyond their categories of life and death, marriage and inheritance, control and power. So if they can't control it, they mock it. And they ridicule what they don't understand. They reject what they cannot explain. And we do the same thing all the time. We create our own little Sadducee scenarios. We come up with extreme examples that we put out there as straw people and ridiculous comparisons to try to make our point and to show we're comfortable, we're justified in it, and anybody else trying to push us, don't bother me, you're ridiculous. I can't talk about this with my spouse because if I do, it'll be the end of the world. I can't tell my child no or put rules on them because they're going to think I don't love them and throw a fit. I can't welcome these type of people into my life because someone might think I approve of everything they've done. We frame our choices in these little false dichotomies of either this or this, all or nothing, right or ruin. But when we do that, we're doing exactly what the Sadducees did. We're trying to trap truth inside these boundaries of our own comfort. Because the resurrection, like the burning bush, it's God's declaration that we cannot be trapped. God will be who he will be. He's going to work in his own way and in his own time. And our part is not to try to reduce the mystery into something safe or sensible. We're just supposed to trust God with whatever the next faithful step is, even when we don't yet see the whole picture. Because when we do, if we're following God in faith, when we don't see the whole picture, then we discover that God's reality is larger, richer, more alive than anything we could have imagined. Because if we could imagine it, then it's not nearly as good as it could be. And what do we do with all this, though? Because honestly, we're not that different from Moses or the Sadducees. We feel inadequate, uncertain, sometimes even unqualified for what God calls us to do, like Moses. We look around and we think, who am I? Who am I to speak? Who am I to lead? Who am I to believe that God could use me? And God is looking and saying, I will be who I will be. It's not whether you're going to be enough. It's that I will be. And God's promise is that it's not that you have it all figured out. It's that he'll be with you even when you don't. So like the Sadducees, we let our discomfort masquerade as logic. When something doesn't fit our ideas, we call it unrealistic and unreasonable. And when God's ways don't fit our expectations, we treat them as if they cannot be true. But faith isn't about explaining mystery. It's about walking within it. You see, when we stop chasing the comfort of tidy answers, when we stop saying, it's got to be this because I don't think the other things make sense to me, something begins to shift in us. We start to notice that how much of our decision-making, how much of it's been shaped by what felt convenient instead of what felt faithful. Instead of saying, this is what's in front of me, when do we start saying, I'm going to wait for God to show me what he wants? You see, we begin to see how easily that we've been settling for what other people told us was reasonable instead of asking for what God was actually saying. Sometimes waiting on God means stepping back from the quick fixes or the easy answers, the ready-made plans that promise certainty but drain our faith. It might mean refusing to rush into the next opportunity just because it looks secure. It might mean pausing before you send that message, before you sign that paper, before you take that job, and instead asking, God, where are you in this? And if you're not, show me not to do it. Waiting on God doesn't mean doing nothing. It means doing the slow, deliberate work of listening. The kind of listening that makes room for God's timing instead of forcing our own. It means listening to sit in the tension between promise and fulfillment without trying to fill the silence ourselves. And often that's where God begins to move. He's in the waiting. He reshapes what we desire. He changes us. He teaches us to trust him, not only for the outcomes that we want, but for the direction he leads. He exposes where we've been relying on approval, control, comparison, and he replaces those things with something far stronger, His presence. Because when you stop taking what the world offers as good enough, you make space for what is truly good, the presence of the I Am, who does not need your timeline or your plan to keep His promises. And in that stillness, when you stop trying to force God into your categories and instead wait on Him to reveal Himself, you begin to see glimpses of His nature. Mysterious, steady, radiant like light itself. And think about light. It's not a wave, it's not a particle, but the moment you try to force it into a box, you miss out on what it really is. If we can stop forcing God into what makes sense to us, then maybe we can see who He really is. So God is not what we may find easy, but God doesn't need to be simple in order to be good. He doesn't need to fit into our plans in order to be faithful. He simply is. So the invitation is this: trust the I Am more than your I understand. Let go of the need to have it all make sense before you say yes. Let God reveal in His own way and time what you cannot yet see, because when you do, you'll start to notice something. The bush still burns today. The voice still calls today. And the resurrection still happens when each and every person believes in Christ Jesus. And when it does, that is when life, real life, begins again. Thanks be to God.